This is a production of Cornell University.
March 16th, 2011, UA meeting.
Well, I've just been informed that we have more than a quorum present, which is exciting. And that means we can do business. And the most important thing right here is the very first item, the minutes from February 23rd. Do I hear any objections to the minutes? You object.
I'm sorry that my mouth is full.
Good.
We'll take a minute. I was reading the minutes, and they're very good, but I distinctly remember you and I and people in the room having a conversation with the president about the emeritus faculty not being able to receive the Cornell Chronicle. At which point, the president remarked, yes, the emeritus faculty are very important to the university. And Tommy Bruce said, I will get back to you on this. I just like those comments somehow included in the minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other additions, corrections, emendations? Well, hearing none, I declare the minutes accepted. Are there any late additions to the agenda?
Yeah.
Yes, Andrew.
If we have a couple minutes or even more than that, I have something. I'm trying to make a very democratic type resolution, get as much input as possible through the student assembly, and hopefully it could pass through this assembly as well. It's for a student bill of rights, which is a new concept as an independent freestanding document. And you know, I've just thought with all our expertise in going through the charter, maybe we could look at this stylistically and grammar and substance and everything. Get as much input as possible.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, I can pass. I'm going to pass.
Ms. Jefferson.
Next on the agenda is the means restriction update. Gentlemen.
Great. Well, thank you for having us.
Well, thank you for coming.
I don't know if I've met all of you. My name is Greg Eald. I'm the director of the counseling service at Gannett.
And I'm Andrew Moderator, Associate University Architect, managing the project.
And we've been doing this talk. We spent all day together on Wednesday, a couple weeks ago, talking about the means restriction project, the bridge barriers, and the architectural designs. My part of the talk was really to kind of facilitate a discussion and talk a little bit about, I think one of the main concerns we've heard is that people are concerned that the university's only response is to put up fences on the bridges, which is really not the case, which is this first slide, really talking about many of the things we've been doing at Gannett within the whole university community, really trying to think about how you promote student mental health, how you promote kind of mental well-being among the student population as a whole. And you can see some of the things broken down here, fostering a healthy educational environment. Those are things that a lot of faculty are really taking very seriously. And these are things, I mean, Charlie's been involved with the Council on Mental Health and Welfare for about what, 7-8 years, Charlie, thinking about these issues, figuring out ways to get faculty and staff involved. So that's a big piece of this. Other pieces, promoting life skills and resilience, those are things we're working with residential life staff, various other staff, and that mental health promotion staff. And I think a part of this larger, what we call the wheel, is really to help people think about where their role is in some of these things. So how you can even do some of those things in classes or other ways in which staff interact with students. Increasing help seeking, anything where we can get people involved, encourage and offer hope about seeking help and seeking health care. That's kind of goes along with identifying people in need. The other piece, you know, providing good mental health and medical services. It's one of the things we really try to do at Gannett is integrate those, which is not usual. It's not the modal way of operating across most universities. So we do things like depression screening, anxiety screening, and substance use screening in primary care. So if you're coming in for an infection or a sprained ankle, we're still going to kind of ask about some of these issues. And it's been interesting, some of the kind of cases that we get and ways in which we offer support to students that maybe never, they would have never gotten it if it wasn't something we took the issue on. So that's a piece of it. Also just delivering coordinated crisis management when there is a crisis, when there's a student death, pulling together the relevant offices and people to really respond. The kind of post-venture piece is oftentimes really important when there is a tragedy. And then the one piece that we're not here to talk about is restricting access to means of suicide. You know, jumping, unfortunately, given our geographical location and some of the geographical uniqueness, accounts for half of the suicides in the last 20 years of Cornell students, and about 30% in Ithaca, which is very unusual. Most places, like urban areas where bridges are the focus, it's about 1 to 2%. You know, nationwide, it's most often firearms, accident, you know, poisoning, chemicals, some of those things. And those are important needs restriction things to think about as well, but unique to us are the bridges and the barriers that are now up. And one of the things after the suicide last year, we brought in consultants from all over who are experts in these areas, and they said, you know, you've really done a lot of these other things. Suicide prevention, mental health promotion are about all these other pieces, but in this environment, the one piece that's missing is anything around means restriction, and that's where some of the research is really leading as an effective way of intervening. So that's the kind of rationale, and that's how we teed this up when we talked to community members and other people at the university about why this is important.
Yeah, I want to ask something else. We're two things we're fixing around. Mm-hmm. So one thing, the meaningfulness of somebody's life is not in there.
You're right.
And I'm afraid that when you don't select for something, you end up selecting against it. And moreover, the university is looking to move in a direction of making things that are measurable important in classes, and I think that will select against meaningful things, and I think that that's as big a problem as anything that's outlined here. Maybe a bigger problem, maybe a more solvable problem, maybe a problem where President Gordon could take an incredible national lead and say something about meaningfulness versus meaninglessness. And on the other hand, one thing that's missing there is the legal context. Does that fit in the colors on the outside and the inside?
The legal context, what do you mean?
Nobody's thought about any of the legal context of this mental health framework?
In terms of liability or in terms of course?
Well, I mean,
you know, I've been involved in a lot of these conversations. I mean, it's always university council's office and risk management that's what they're thinking about these things. But, you know, I think the part of this wheel is to try to develop structures that are going to prevent that outcome. Which we talk to any attorney, that's where your liability is.
Mm-hmm. So that is the outside white piece?
Yeah.
Side white piece? The center?
Definitely not the center. I mean, I think it's more of a, at least the way I think about it, is this is more of a foundation that's going to mitigate some of that liability.
Okay, so I just want to say both of those things because I think that's a meaningful discussion.
Okay, yeah, and I think just one thing around,
I'm happy with
around meaning is that, you know, as I still do some psychotherapy, and that's an issue that comes up all the time. You know, students coming here and not having a bigger sense of why they're here, why they're studying as much as they're studying. You know?
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about what you promote. I was working with Tim Marshall on the recent mandatory orientation event to talk about mental health and instill that in from day one. But I think of the most recent death, which wasn't a suicide. It was some fraternity member was left after being alcohol poisoned by the fraternity brothers. And I think life skills, if there was more education about how to recognize signs of mental health and signs of alcohol poisoning, I think they kind of go together. That could have done a lot to prevent an unnecessary death. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and one of the interesting things we've done in these community meetings, in the first one, which was the Wednesday after the Ithaca College student died and the Cornell student died, the Torres died, it definitely came up. Well, this is great, but what about, what are you doing around alcohol? And that's a huge piece of it. I mean, I think our university is in conversation about the Greek system, which is a therapist. I mean, my reaction was, I'm surprised this doesn't happen more often. I mean, you know, any student can tell you it's pretty heavy, risky drinking, and drinking's about the context. You know, and the Greek system, as you know, is a context where a lot of social support for a lot of alcohol use. And I think that's a whole other conversation.
I agree this thing kind of happens periodically, and it's always in the back of our heads that this kind of thing could happen, but knowing a little bit about what actually happened and how he was left there and how now the prosecutors are, I hear, are trying to charge four students with manslaughter, as a result of this, I think education was probably a core component that was just lacking, which these forms.
Well, and you know, you probably talked to Tim about some of this. I mean, the hard piece with substance use is, you know, for a lot of the research I've seen, education doesn't necessarily change behavior. So knowing a lot about alcohol poisoning doesn't mean you're going to not engage in ritualistic behavior.
How do you make that part of the culture? You recognize it, you know, call 911. I mean, it's very simple.
Right. Well, and you change some of the culture around extreme drinking. I mean, you do things to change the context. I mean, a lot of the things that have been shown to work, you know, looking at alcohol outlet densities in college town or fraternities in that kind of context, I think it goes beyond education, I guess.
Andrew, can we continue with the,
sure.
the presentation?
No, because they're great questions.
I mean, these
it's
are
like
good points.
Ball I'm hitting. I understand.
They're great questions, and I think our frustration, even at Gannett, is how do you? Because that's how we felt about it. Right. Tim's felt about it too. Is how do we get up against some of these cultures that really don't want to change? And that, I guess, all I'm saying to you is education is much more complicated than that. Those messages. You also have to change this culture and context, but a lot of people are really invested in keeping this safe. So I didn't mean to put up a brick wall around that. I mean, I've had some of the same frustration.
Yeah.
Because in CAPS, we see the fallout. We see the consequences of the sexual assault, the kind of trauma that results from some of this stuff. So,
well, there are some proven methods that have worked, and I have some experience with this from my previous job in the Air Force, where I happened to be located at a base that had the worst underage and drinking statistics of any Air Force base in the entire Department of Defense. So there's an enforcement piece, there is an education piece, but you also need people in each of the fraternities that sign on to be examples to others, and that doesn't mean they don't drink, but it's they're key groups, and it's a whole thing. That just saying don't do this or saying there's education materials won't work. It takes a whole process to that, and it also talks about educating the effects of, like, so many drinks, you're liable to do one stupid thing, and as soon as you get to four or five drinks in a certain time period, you're likely to do five or six undesirable things, from get into a fight to have, you know, unplanned or unprotected, or you know, and the consequences go up pretty significantly as you go between drink three and four in a certain period of time, and so. I guess what I, following up on this, and I don't, not to take up too much time, but there are college groups that specialize in getting that rate down. You know, suicide being, you know, or not recognizing alcohol poisoning is obviously one terrible effect. But there are groups out there that specialize in these kinds of materials. And are we working with other universities on our drinking culture to keep it, I guess, within a certain norm, bounds? You won't eliminate the problem, but you can constructively keep it, you know,
right.
And that's the risk as low as it reasonably could be.
And many of you know Tim, I mean, that was his original position here, was to do that kind of work. So it's much more about the prevention piece and more about the treatment piece in terms of when people develop problems or having.
Guys, this is a huge topic. So let's get on with the order of the day, otherwise we'll just get lost.
So thanks for your questions.
Sure. Yeah, I have a lot of slides, so I'll try to go through them a reasonable amount of time, and leave some time at the end of the discussion. But first, I've got several designs to show, but first I'd like to just talk about the process that got us where we are today. Prior to where we are today, and actually that blue line should be moved over to the middle of the pre-schematic design, we had a six-week site analysis technical review and Cornell literature review with our consultants, where they actually came here. The idea was to understand our bridges, our landscape, gather data, and explore technical aspects and materials. And now we're in the pre-schematic phase, and this is really a kind of pre-decisional phase where the idea is to take a look at all the options out there. So our architects have been charged to come up with three schemes, unique schemes for each of the seven regions. And so in this presentation, you'll see some examples of schemes with fences, schemes with nets, and other artful approaches. And part of the pre-schematic phase is also about reaching out to the community, presenting the community with some designs that we can then gather feedback for. And we have a website with a web link that people can provide their comments, and I'll show that at the end. And you know, all of this is planning to, for the next schematic design phase, where eventually May 31st, we'll be submitting it to the City of Ithaca for approval, and also during the month of May, obtaining BNP approval. So this is a slide that was selected by the architects, and the reason I put this up here is just to illustrate kind of our thinking behind hiring NADA, who are the architects. They were formerly Avista, but now they're called NADA. And this is a slide that Nadir Tirani kind of has been presenting. And the idea is that you know, we could have just hired a consultant who was kind of a safety consultant or a civil engineer to kind of solve this problem, but we were looking for someone who had a more artful approach and could come up with something more provocative. And I think NADA has actually been very successful in doing that. So here's a layout, a map showing all the seven bridges. You see the Stewart Ave bridges are vehicular bridges, Thurston Ave also, and then we also have three pedestrian bridges, Suspension Bridge, BB Dam, and Trolley Bridge, and then also the Stone Arch Bridge, which is unique in itself, but kind of an iconic bridge within our landscape. So part of the materials kind of exploration phase, took a look at you know, three different approaches. One is a bar system, where you use these you know, bars spaced roughly 4 inches or more, depending on what the code allows, and that offers some unique opportunities with opening up views. Then also they took a look at glass wall systems. This is an example from Rockefeller Center. This has its benefits. It's clear. They can use very clear glass. But you have reflection. You also have the issue of dirt and cleaning. And, you know, on the roof of Rockefeller Center, I'm sure some of the signs to clean the glass regularly, but how will that work in our situation? And then another interesting material that they've explored is this tensile steel mesh, which is essentially a steel cable that is crimped together into a mesh. It can come in various sizes, gauges of wire. But what you see here in the image above is that it becomes, from a distance, from certain angles, can become very transparent in some way. And there's different, you know, all of these, part of the study was to look at all these different materials and look at them. What do they look like frontally? What do they look like from the oblique? What do they look like from far away? So I'm going to start with the first bridge set of designs, the Stewart Ave Bridge from Cascadilla Creek. You know, this is a steel truss vehicular bridge with an arched structural system, and NADA took a look, you know, as part of the consideration for each bridge, they took a look at the landscape around it, the blue lights nearby, and those type of considerations. And so here they kind of documented the existing condition. And this is one of the proposals, which is a bar system. And the idea is not to just lay down this kind of static bar system, but actually modulate the top of it as you get to the more dangerous parts of the bridge. And so that adds some kind of form and interest to the design. And you can see here what that might look like from the bridge level. You know, actually, this is very hard to see.
Maybe contrast.
The colors. Let me be able to. Might be that the.
This projector is awful.
Yeah.
It tends to do that. So.
Drawings and this image looks great on my screen, but so here's a view looking from the bridge out, you can see frontally, you know, the gaps between the bars. And in this situation, you know, these bridges, the outside rail is also vehicular. Yes, people can stand behind me if you really want to see the image. And also, this whole presentation is on the web also. So these bridges have a very strong vehicular rail on the outside, so that's what you're seeing down below. And then this lighter system would be attached to the top of it. And then from below in the gorge, and that's also part of the consideration, is what do these look like, these insertions look like from inside the swimming gorge.
In the middle, there are dips down. What's the height of the bars in the middle?
I think it's the angle at which they're angled.
Yeah, what you're seeing is because they angle in at that kind of area, the center of the bridge is really the most dangerous spot, and so it modulates in at that point. It makes it more difficult to scale. Okay, so that's one scheme. The other scheme, which you'll see on several of the bridges, there's kind of some typologies and things that are consistent that carry through from bridge to bridge, is a netting system that's suspended below the bridge. used for catching. This is actually something, and I believe we may have some slides later that show the Golden Gate Bridge. It's been explored for that application also. This, you know, we've received a lot of comments on this. There's usually the question of, well, what happens if someone throws something onto there? How does it get retrieved? And I think those are all valid.
Things like sofas and kegs. They're already there.
There's a lot can be done with sizing the openings, to allow certain things to fall through, like weeds and things like that. But the great thing about this is that, you know, you have unobstructed views. And then here's a view of it from down below in the gorge. You know. Another hybrid of this concept would be to stretch cables from gorge wall to gorge wall and not actually attached to the physical bridge structure. So this has its own set of opportunities or concerns for us about how it would be maintained. Again, views would be minimal and given to see from below.
So I take it the idea with that is someone hops off and they say, well, I changed my mind. Because what can you just standing and walking the edge and hopping off?
It's usually, from what I understand, an impulsive event. And I guess it's been documented that people who survived or usually discover once that they've actually made the move that they decided was a bad decision. So that would really be needed, slowing down the process. Right?
Mm-hmm. This is what means restriction is. It's not prevention. I mean, it's not.
Well, those bars are fairly preventive. I mean, you have to be a circus performer to scale those things.
Discouragement.
I mean, from that perspective, a net is the same effect.
I mean, the idea is that it does kind of give them pause. I mean, so when we have a net betray here, which you have published a study where they put up thorn bushes as an effective deterrent. It wasn't like they were impossible to get through, but just they were enough to kind of create some physical pain and disrupt the net.
Well, but also, you know, I'm not in favor of a fence or anything at this point, but you see somebody scaling that. Somebody hops off, they've already done it. Okay. So I see something like what's up now as much more of a preventive than having, you know, a trapeze net down at the bottom to catch someone who's already made the decision to go, and you don't have the opportunity to stop them. You see somebody climbing the barrier, you can do something before they get to the top. So, I mean,
the pimple steel mesh, so it's not so much a net, but I mean, it would be painful, I think.
It would not be a good experience. There's quite a bit of give in the net. It's hard. It's not easy just to scale out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen them. So it was just.
Yeah, that was an interesting observation. So the Stewart Ave Bridge over Fall Creek, which here's the truss structure underneath, here's the existing condition. And, similar proposal there, the bar system that modulates itself towards the center. Unfortunately, bad projection here, it's hard to see. But the intent is, roughly 4 inches is the code, at least at the lower levels is kind of the code required minimum. And
then here you can see from below. They also had this other idea about this kind of catchment structure, you know, similar to the, it's a net structure with a tensile steel mesh, but it just, it takes a slightly different approach to it. And here you can see, you know, from the deck, you wouldn't see that structure again. It's hard to see in this image, but the idea was that those kind of diagonals, the uprights to support this new approach to catchment kind of disappears within the trussing of the bridge visually. Mm-hmm. And then here, similar to what you saw before, the horizontal. Yeah.
A little question about the
sure.
So the nets are really this tensile steel, right? But that tensile steel, you said, doesn't have much flex to it. So it's going to be fairly rigid, and somebody throws a keg down there, it's going to bend and,
yes.
and morph out of shape, right?
Yeah.
So then how, these various options, how easy is it to replace parts of this tensile steel mesh when it starts to get really damaged and ratty looking?
It's quite easy to replace sections of it.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, our consultants have been exploring concepts about, you know, ways to pull the hole in that end to service it close to the bridge. I mean, those are all, you know, there's a lot of operational challenges mm-hmm. with this system especially.
How often do they foresee it's going to need services?
You know, we haven't gotten to that yet. I think it's a really important point. Yeah.
And how expensive would it be?
Yeah, from an operational standpoint. I think I really don't have access ways, catwalks to get in closer as opposed to having to drop people down on ropes and cables to service it. There may be trucks with arms and things. That'll be, you know, if this turns out to be something to be explored in the schematic design phase, I think those kind of details will be explored further. But I think there's a known operational concern there.
Yeah, my feeling is when, whether it's bridges or saddles or anything you're talking about, as soon as you get to these difficult questions after the first few slides,
yeah,
something seems to be wrong.
So the Thurston Ave Bridge has actually two arches, you know, one below and one above. It's a pretty difficult form to work with as far as the bridge goes. You can see here the kind of existing condition. And what they've proposed is kind of continuing the shape of the arch by setting up a framework with the steel mesh on it, but also removing the existing guardrails, which are quite large, mm-hmm. and this really opens up opportunities to have great views now mm-hmm. right down into the gorge. And this would also require, though, because they've the kind of massive guardrails on the outside, which were originally designed for, you can see in this section here, the rails that exist there were designed to stop vehicular traffic. And so now what they're proposing is that they may you could put a bench along the inside curb side, and that would provide a place for seating and contemplation along the way while you cross the bridge. And poor picture, but this gives you an idea of what that approach would be. In a lot of ways, it could be a very nice way to open up views. It's good to note that this tensile steel mesh also is available in black too, so that's a lot less visible.
Do they have font colors?
Yeah. Let's see here. Then, of course, we've seen this in the previous bridges in the approach where you put a horizontal net there. And, of course, and here you can see the existing rail. Let's see what this one is. Okay. This one, they're exploring a notion of a covered bridge. And kind of extending the mesh up and around with this upper roof structure that almost creates an eyebrow and on top of the bridge, and then kind of modulates itself and tapers into a bench down at this end. It would have to be a very light structure. It would hang over and have a similar you know, bench over there on that side.
You just made me think of something that might be somewhat pretty.
Since this is a region that historically had covered bridges, if they made wood covered bridges,
I've been asking for that for a while.
Keep asking. I think personally this is an insane way to deal with insanity. but anyhow, that's my suggestion.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
Our suggestion.
The covered bridge, though. The covered bridge concept is very interesting.
Yeah.
The architect did propose that the underside of it which could be a wood, an ebonized wood. So they're definitely thinking about those type of things. And that would be a view of the covered bridge scenario. So here we have the Stone Arch Bridge in Collegetown. Very unique, iconic bridge. Much shorter span than the other bridges. And here they're proposing the glass panel solution along the inside. There you can see, the transparency of the glass panel. It would have about a 4-inch gap between the panels, which would allow breezes to come through, that type of thing. But it's put on the inside just because of the nature of that thick exterior rail. I mean, you can't try to put it on the outside, and it has to become extremely tall. People can stand up on that rail. And I know that there have been, even before this bridge was rebuilt, the rail was even lower, the stone. Mm-hmm. And people would walk across it.
People walked across it with tall fences.
Yeah, even when it was raised that higher, very risky.
Can you do that? How would you keep them from?
That's a good point, and it doesn't really show. It's hard to see here, but you would actually have a glass panel that would.
It's very subtle, but it's
very hard to
see.
It
would be right out there.
It just sort of comes out a little bit, so you can't go around it.
Yeah.
So, realistically, this is a college town. Somebody really thought about putting glass panels on the outside in a college town? It's like an invitation. Break me. Deface me. Paint me.
Yeah.
They're really thinking of doing that?
it's one of several options that are under consideration. It's a tough problem. They're proposing it. I think comments we've heard about that, stickers on it, scratches, snow. I mean, I was on the bridge, last week, and you can just imagine the amount of snow piling up against that glass. I mean, how do you keep that clean?
Well, I mean, if a keg in the net in the meshing is going to be a problem, think of a keg going through.
You're going to want to broadcast their, fraternity sorority during that particular week of the year.
look at the pensions that we have. You think we'll have a serious thing to face?
This is an invitation for stickers, if we're not.
Yeah. So this is just one option. It's one option. You kind of have to show it to knock it down in a lot of ways.
We're getting kind of close to time.
Okay, so I'll really try to hustle through. So here, similar, spanning, boards wall, that approach could have its merits there. This is another approach where you span from boards wall to boards wall and then tie into the arch of the stone bridge. So now I guess we're going to go to the pedestrian bridges. This is the trolley bridge here. Given the nature of the handrail there, there's opportunities to easily remove it. And the bridge, as it goes through the woods there, it's almost like this kind of room in the woods. It's very intimate. And they're kind of proposing this notion of this kind of enclosed space within the bridge that with seating and that just crossing the bridge could be an experience in itself. And again, modulating the bar system around like that. Here you can see the bench on the lower right. There's a view from the outside. Another concept that they've explored is this idea of a triangulated structure on that bridge and then spanning between the triangulation with the central steel mesh, which is very structurally can be very light and effective. And there's a view of that. And again, a lot of the approaches with the mesh, you're taking the mesh down to the deck. You really can start to experience the view out from the bridge. Now, We've had a lot of discussions about, well, what about people who have fear of heights, you know, so you need to take a look at that. And also maintenance, which probably would need to be a curb along the bottom to deal with stone removal and that sort of thing. This is a tensegrity structure, kind of hybrid is what they call it, where you just, you're actually, you have vertical struts and then horizontal struts sitting going across the bridge. So that's one other approach to the trolley bridge. The BB dam bridge is very similar to the trolley bridge, although the environment around it is quite different. You know, you've got the lake up above, which has this nice horizontal body of water, and then to the west you've got the sea gorge. So there they're looking at a similar approach, removing the rails, but then kind of modulate the form to respond to the two different sides of the gorge. And seating and how far you take the extend that steel bar system, and then again a triangulated mesh, and they also talk about opening up holes along the kind of roof of that, and try to create kind of oculi along the roof, and then a triangulated structure there. The suspension bridge is really, you know, quite spectacular, unique in its own way. It has a bar system there already, but part of the problem is that given the nature of the suspension structure, there is you have the ability to actually reach up and grab the cables and pull yourself over. So that needs to be addressed. And one approach.
But is that a problem for the impulsive jumper?
Well, it's happened. I mean,
it's happened. So
it's a concern. You know, looking at that bridge, it's already, you notice it's got a little bit of bounce on it. It's definitely at its load capacity. So any work on that would involve removing that existing bar system. And one concept, which is quite interesting, is taking that tensile steel fabric mesh and kind of cocooning the bridge, especially in the areas of danger. See here. So that would look something like that. And it's quite interesting because, you know, that bridge originally did not have any bars, protective bars like that. It was just an open truss. So that would bring that back to the experience when crossing the bridge. From below. And then here's a kind of revised bar scheme, which puts the tightly clustered bars kind of at guardrail height, which is the code 42 inches. And then above that, the bars can be spaced further, but still raised high enough so it can discourage the use of the cables. And that could, like the other bridges, modulate itself based on the danger level. And then again, spanning with a net system and boards. And in this case, the bridge can't bear the struts, so it would have to really be from gorge wall to gorge wall. And there's a view of that. So as far as next steps, right now there's, you know, we're collecting public comments through the website at www.needrestrictionstudy.fs.cornell.edu. We're looking to select a specific direction for each bridge to develop a schematic design. And as I mentioned, we'll be submitted to the BNP May 27th, and a package will go to the city on the 31st.
BNP is
Buildings and Properties, Living and Trustees. So any questions?
Yes, go ahead, Mark.
Now, I know it's a little bit early, you're still in the design phase, but have you guys thought about a work plan and the process for reconstructing these bridges and the barriers that are currently on there? After these plans are approved, do you do, you know, one bridge at a time? You know, I remember when Thurston Ave was closed down and just how much construction that cost the university. And, you know, I guess my big question is, how long are some of these things going to take to transition from what we have now to what we hope to see?
Well, I think it depends on which scheme.
Yeah.
You know, each has its own level of disruption. But, you know, these aren't huge construction projects. You know, hopefully these things could be accomplished in the summer or, you know, a month if things are set up right. And you know, it depends on how we put it on the bid, whether it's all in a package and how the sequence is. But yeah, I think those are good questions that we'll have to address during this probably design development and construction document phase. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for coming and talking with us and presenting this material. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
And I think we need to proceed with the rest here. Evan, you want to talk about the CCA?
Sure. So, as you recall, the resolution that we passed six weeks ago, calls for two main things. It calls for a public meeting to be held by the provost or his designee with interested parties to include faculty, staff, and students. And it calls for the reinstatement of individual grants, as I believe the phrase is, a constituent component of the Cornell Council for the Arts. I let you know that the dean of AAP, Ken Kleinman, has held some meetings. These meetings were, they're not secret smoke-filled room meetings. Basically, he asked the director, whom we met when we voted on the resolution, interim director Judith Kellogg, to pick some people that she thought would bring useful input. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to do that. And actually, so was Nighthawk, our graduate student elected trustee. He's been attending those meetings as well. There hasn't been an undergraduate student present, though I know one was invited. She was won a scholarship from the CCA, but she hasn't been able to make it to any of the meetings. Anyway, the meetings have been interesting and fruitful, but I suppose this is inevitable because, of course, things have already been decided and the provost has already signed off on a plan of action. There's very little actual effect that can be had. So the dean has been very accommodating and gracious with his time to listen to concerns, but I don't get the sense that he's going to change anything. He has a very clear idea of how he sees this working, and that's the way it's going to work. Basically, as relates to the second point first, the individual grants, what he envisions happening, and he's talked to several other deans and effectively, I was going to say twisted their arms. He didn't have to twist very hard. We're not talking about very much money. He got them to commit to continuing to fund the arts within their colleges. And the debate has basically centered around the procedure for implementing this. I suggested, at least I think I was the first to suggest it, something to the effect of the various colleges or units who have been tapped to contribute this grand total of $70,000 of funding, channeling that funding into the CCA and the CCA maintaining its existing grant apparatus, which seems to work. And the opposite perspective, the one advocated by the dean but by others as well, has basically been to have each college do it on their own. I mean, you can sort of see, it's not that this is bad. Ultimately, the arts get funded. And this is basically what the dean says. I don't see what the problem is. We're still giving you money. In fact, we're probably giving you more money than we used to because there's been a real focus on students here. He basically goes to the deans and he says, we need to fund students. And they say, yes, I'm in favor of that. Because faculty already have some outlets to which students do not have access for this sort of funding. It seems to me and to others on this same committee, not committee, but meeting group, that it's effectively reinventing the wheel. We've got a process that's been in place for 40 years, and now we're proposing however many separate processes with different criteria administered in an inconsistent way. Anyway, so there's a concern, but I think that's basically the way it's going to work. Fair enough. As to the public meeting, and this is my final point, the dean didn't say a lot about this during the meeting, but after the meeting, I realize this is in some sense a public forum. We keep minutes, and so this isn't a secret or anything, but basically approached me and said, if we were to have an actual public hearing about this, and this is a rough paraphrase of what he said, I would be forced to strongly defend my position, basically. And it came out, and it would have been nice, I think, if this had been disclosed earlier, that he didn't feel the individual grants were working very well. The process is not especially competitive, that in many cases it's a sort of rubber stamp, that 100% or 90% or 80% or depending on the year, but the majority of proposals are funded. And of course the response to that, and this is what came up in the meeting, is, well, of course that's the way it is because they've been vetted and they've gone through the process and they've needed to have sponsoring faculty, and by the time they reach the committee, they're pretty good proposals. So anyway, there's that. But he basically felt that he might offend some people if he had to, you know, face off in a public forum. So that's the status. I think our resolution has spurred on a debate. I don't know if it's going to change the outcome, but I think it's good that we're having the discussion.
Good. Any further on that one? Are you going to talk about response biases?
I could if you want to.
Well, it's on the agenda for 3 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Just in time.
yeah, absolutely. Just in time.
So the first meeting went relatively well. We had about 12 to 15 people show up. Some were employees. Some, I think, were students. But overall, we got a good meeting going on, talking about how we can improve the bias response programs, what are some appropriate remedies. What did show up from the things that we heard, though, is that they want, as a victim of bias, they would want to see something concrete. They would want to see something that we would do in response to the perpetrator, I guess. The second meeting, which I just came back from, was basically a failure. Besides the people who were required to come, I think about 2 to 3 came, I want to say at best, but they're not really the people. They didn't originally come for this bias response program. I had to go to them and say, oh, there's free cookies and there's water, soda. No brownies, though.
But this was the one targeted at graduate students, basically. It was in the Big Red Barn.
Yes,
Big Red Barn.
I have another meeting.
So we didn't really get too much from the graduate students, at least. Our next meeting is during spring break, so most of the students won't be there, but it's going to be targeted for the employees, which is actually one of our main concerns, especially because the pressures, as bad as it is, if a student reports a bias, he's not going to feel hesitant to report it. He's going to be more willing to report it since he doesn't have an authority above him generally. This is not the case with employees and faculty, so we want to hear what they think about it.
Good. Thank you. Sure. Any comments?
Yes, sir. Regarding graduate students showing up to things, do you know how it was advertised? I know we forwarded something to the GPSA list this morning. Well, late last night.
Yeah, I should have got that to the GPSA sooner. It was Lynette had wrote an article in the Chronicle that listed the dates of the bias response program, and that was pretty much the advertisement that was able to attract people for the first one. Whether or not, because that was the initial wave of interest, just went to the first meeting. And then I tried posting it on Facebook a little bit, but there wasn't a whole lot else other than that. I don't know if the...
I think his name is... I was informed that there's something that we did, a little bit of advertising with Paul Pence. I'm not sure if that's any different.
If Paul Pence is for the graduate students, would typically operate the policy.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for the sort of undergraduate apparatus, but the apparatus for graduate and professional students communication we've got GPSA info, but that goes out infrequently.
Yeah.
It could go in there, but the last one was a while ago, and the next one would be for a while. The other way is to get people to forward to their fields, but that takes a couple of days for people to get the message and then forward it on, if they forward it on.
And the idea here, too, when Lynette scheduled locations is that this one wasn't just for graduate students, or the first one wasn't just for faculty or employees or undergrads.
You just tailored it so it would be more convenient for them.
Right.
Yeah, have at least one location that would be inviting to...
I'm just trying to think of ways to get, at least from my perspective, more graduate professional students to show up to your next meeting.
Yeah, I'll get the info. I guess you guys have it now, but I'll get a better set together, and I'll contact Jen and have it so that you can say info.
Okay, anything more about biasing?
If we have time, I was just hoping that we can maybe brainstorm ideas on better marketing strategies.
Let's go through some of these other things first.
Okay.
I now have an item from the president who recommends that Mary Beth Grant be reappointed as judicial administrator July 1st, 2011 through June 30th, 2013. And this needs to be approved by the assembly.
Motion to approve.
Second. Motion, second. Any discussion?
I'm a little surprised that this is a 2-year appointment and this person has been in it for many, many years.
But it is, by legislation, a 2-year appointment.
Right, and that's what that's my interest. Why did they make it 2 years if they didn't want it to turn over? Is there something going on here that...
No, I think it was just simply to make it easier to make it turn over if that seemed like desirable.
Okay. Over the years, I've asked if it could be a 5-year appointment to guarantee actually more independence. But
no, well, the campus code, we can refer to the codes of judicial committee and they can opine, you know, if we want to.
Thank you.
Hearing no further discussion, all in favor, raise your hand. Okay, unanimous. Anybody opposed? Anybody abstaining? Anybody not here? Oh. Okay.
I have one thing about the business.
Yes, please do.
Sorry. On Monday, the committee to appoint the new Judicial Code Counselor met, and we interviewed six Cornell Law students. All were very impressive, and we ultimately recommended... we ranked three of them and submitted that proposal to President Swarton, who will then make the final appointment, but we assume that he will appoint the person that recommended.
Good. Thank you. We are now at the Section 8, the bylaws discussion, and fortunately Ed is here to guide us through this labyrinth.
Well, I don't suppose actually that this needs to be a labyrinth. This is we've already passed the bylaws once before, and we've had some discussion about it, and obviously they've been around for people to read for quite some time, just to kind of dot the I's and cross the T's and make sure that this is what we want, because we spent a considerable amount of time with the charter, we spent some time with the bylaws, but just to end with the bylaws and make sure that this is... So that next year's assembly doesn't have to deal with these issues. That you know, the grant is there, the final pieces are in place. So, I mean, we may even get lucky, and this is the last time we substantially talk about this. But we'll see how that goes. And I know Randy had emailed one thing that he wanted to discuss. Any members, if there's anything else, I just kind of went through to note some of the things. So talking with you guys probably all saw my email. So talking with David Leaves, the Associate Director of Transportation, his only concern is that we've now removed the UA's duty in staffing the Transportation Hearing and Appeals Board. This is basically a 3-member board that if you get a parking ticket or don't get approved for a certain pass on campus, if Transportation says, you know, yes, we think you still deserve this, your final step is to go to this hearing and appeals board. David, typically we basically have very little role in it other than the staffing gets done through us. David would just prefer that's still a formal process because it's then that way it's not their staffing a committee which reviews their decisions already. So I think that that seems pretty fair. Does anybody have any objections to that? If we thought that was fine, I would just basically task Ari to draft the email.
This
get
is
something.
This is one would be an associated committee.
It would be an associated.
I think
not
it would be more.
Anyway.
I think the analogy would be if we go to.
I think it's what we just did with reappointing, something we have to do.
If we go to the new charter, okay, so there's a section about the staffing of the university hearing and review boards here. Mm-hmm. So I think this would be analogous to that function, so maybe proposing a 3.2.3, amending the new charter with its first
Okay. We could also.
Have we ever done this before? I mean, I've been on this committee
staff
20 some odd years. I don't remember ever. I remember hearing boards, and I don't remember anything to do with a three person appeals of transportation board that we had anything to do with.
It's been in the charter, sort of nested under the Transportation Advisory Committee, even though one is an advisory committee on policy and the other one actually makes decisions about people's tickets.
Can't we just put it in the bylaws somewhere? I don't want to fiddle with the charter. We
and
finally got the damn thing done.
So that would be an associated.
I just think it's not an associated.
It's
I mean, that's what I was thinking, that it could just be an associated committee in the bylaws. I'm hoping we don't have to fiddle with the charter. If we want to fiddle with the charter, we might just be able to email the president and be like,
fiddling with the charter so much as just adding one more aspect of UA's authority, which UA has been given the authority to do. It's just it never was put in the charter. It always ended up in this stuff.
We're just going to email the president and amendment to the charter we just sent him.
a separate action.
Does it have to be an amendment? Oh, if we go and do this, it's going to take forever because we got to propose it at the meeting and wait for another meeting in order to move it. And whereas if we can just stick it quietly in the bylaws in some, useful place, it really accomplishes the same thing, doesn't it?
Yeah. All right. And I think that's the proper place for it.
I think so, too.
Where is this committee defined? Who's on it? How do we select people? I mean, the hearing board has a rigid structure for how you find people. We interview them. We do all of that. Maybe I should have read this. Like I said, I've never heard of this before.
Well,
I can't imagine transportation would just allow three undergraduates.
The way it has worked so far is that it's staffed by the various constituent assemblies, which is why it's been kind of hampered for a long time, because like many UA committees, it doesn't actually get staffed because it's such a low priority, even though it's an important group. Mm-hmm.
So let me also clarify, according to David, this group meets very, very infrequently. Transportation is generally pretty understanding with many issues and working and explaining them to people. There's very, very infrequent use of this body. He just wants it to not be staffed internally by him because they're passing judgment on stuff.
Right. So it says the Transportation Hearing and Appeals Board is associated with it. I haven't looked into the transportation rules just because David Leib has always handled that on his own. He's never had to come to us. I don't think transportation decisions or parking ticket decisions are nearly as controversial as things that the judicial administrator is involved with. But, so it's sort of embedded in tax charge that, oh, by the way, the UA also has this hearing and appeals board, and then it says that it's staffed by the respective assemblies, and in their governing documents there's nothing about this board. So,
well, why don't we arrange it in the bylaws so that this is a UA group which will be staffed by the UA, and just put it in someplace.
Yeah. I think we can drop it in the file. If there's no objection to that, then we'll
I think it belongs here.
I'll convince Ari.
Well, it's just, you know, the UA doesn't have any authority to make decisions about people's parking tickets right now. So,
no, but it does have a legitimate appeal. And their request is perfectly reasonable. They don't want to be seen as being the judge over their own affairs, so they're asking an outside group to do it. We're the obvious group to do it.
But this is a general welfare.
Right. There's no problem.
I agree with you completely, but that's why I should be in the charter as part of the UA's authority.
Well, if you want to vote, let's vote.
There's no motion on the floor, so
I mean, I'd be happy to draft something up, and yes, it would take some time, but
I would say the one thing that I'm worried about is if we put this in the bylaws, we already have one thing that's analogous to. We start to create a dirty kind of messy system. You know, we have a nice clean system already, and let's try and keep it as clean as we can.
This is clean
and consistent.
This is clean. We have a number of associated committees. And this would be a perfectly reasonable one to do. Park administration.
It could be a subcommittee of the campus welfare committee, for instance.
But it's not. But it's our point is that it's not our committee. Yeah. It's not the UA. It's some other.
And neither are the associated committees. In fact, the UA has no authority whatsoever over those committees aside from it says that their chairs will be non-voting ex officio members of the UA.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in that. So that is. To Ed's point, that couldn't we make the Transportation Hearing and Appeals Board an associated committee? We don't have authority over it. It's not the UA that's hearing these things. We're just saying we will staff this committee.
And I think that's exactly the Luke's. I don't think he cares if it's a UA committee or not. He just wants us staffing it.
Right.
Makes sense.
Well, that's not something UA currently does.
That's
well, it. We don't do anything that was in our charter, so it doesn't make a difference.
Let's talk offline about it. And okay. I think when we got most of what this body wants, we'll see if we can do
it. Okay.
Right. We can figure out a way that we can do it. The next thing that I had noted, and I'll just go through my notes and then we'll see what other people have that they've noted. Ex officio members of the UA, right now we have a number of ex officio members in our current charter. Our newly adopted charter has, if I read it correctly, the only ex officio members are the chairs of the associated committees. Right? Do we want to add in the student elected trustees as ex officio members? The VPs or directors of units that we're assuming authority over as ex officio members?
What does it mean to be ex officio? I mean, people can attend our meetings and speak at them. These people wouldn't be able to vote.
It means they're ex officio. My understanding is they're members of the UA without voting rights. You are a member of the University of Columbia, you just won't have voting rights.
Just a reminder, ex officio does not necessarily mean non-voting.
By virtue of their position.
Yeah, but the chair is that will be members of the UA next year are technically ex officio members.
Right.
Of
course.
By default.
What I mean to say, and granted my UA experience doesn't go back very far, but in my experience on the UA, our ex officio members have never attended. Not once in the year that I've been on this. Which is fine.
Well, okay, Mike did attend when he
was. And again, that is before my albeit very limited experience.
I'm not pushing this. I just wanted to bring this up. This is something that I noticed a change to make sure that people...
I think we should have the student trustees.
Yes, I second that because that would give us a contact into the Board of Trustees. I mean, that's important.
Okay. We also had the employee trustee in the past.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then there's the whole question of, well, do we have faculty trustees as well?
Yeah, I would say...
All the constituent,
trustees should be ex officio members. I don't believe they'll come, but I think it's a good precedent.
And particularly when we have something going on that involves that group, then we can get trustees in. I mean, we can invite them and they'll come.
I think this is very good. I think this is very a good link as a former trustee myself, a good link to the wider constituency.
Okay. So what I'm planning to do is anything that we figure as a sense here should change, work on it between now and the next meeting, and then the next meeting have a resolution to change that.
So going to Article 1 of the bylaws.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Additional points.
Good stuff. The next thing that I just wanted to have us look at is the charges of the standing committees. So not exactly labeled the charge of the standing committee, but are we happy with basically what we tasked the standing committee to do? And luckily we have three of them, so not a whole huge discussion there.
Well, I have a problem with that.
There we go.
If you look at 5.1, Codes and Judicial Committee, they recruit and appoint members to university hearing and review boards. You turn the page to the Campus Welfare Committee, they recruit and appoint members to the university hearing and review boards.
Yeah,
I foresee difficulty.
Yes,
I
do. Yeah, go ahead, that question.
I don't particularly care which one does what, but I think only one of them should do it.
Right. Probably CJC, right?
That sounds right.
Yeah, I think CJC. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Then we just strike it out.
From 5.2.
Okay.
Can anybody read this thing from 5.2?
Mm-hmm. I think it's actually pretty solid. Mike and I were talking on the way down here. It's generally pretty solid. I'm just going to strike from campus welfare, staffing.
Mm-hmm. They've got enough to do anyway.
Yeah.
I've been championing this document on the GPSA side of things. We just passed our own charter, which is material. I've been saying, look at the UA charter, look how they do it.
Nice. Anybody who has problems with 5.1, 5.2, like definitions of 5.3? 5.1, 5.2 are CJC and campus infrastructure?
No, they're fine.
Okay. 5.3 is campus infrastructure. By delegation to the assembly, the committee will review and any proposed motion to environmental and sustainability, information technology, transportation and commuter policies, and any other topic deemed relevant to the campus infrastructure by the executive board. I don't like the word infrastructure.
In the name of the committee.
In the name of the committee. It's just not sexy. It's not.
What name would you propose?
I'm not there yet, actually, unfortunately, and I've been. I know. I hate when I just don't bring it. But the sustainability committee met yesterday, and I brought this issue to them about how we're trying to streamline the UA's operation, and this, you know, the one term that people kind of rear back on was the word infrastructure, and I feel the same way about it. I could see it being campus, environment, transportation, and technology committee. Or I know that's a mouthful, but
yeah, that's a nasty acronym.
But it's just it's brutalist. That's one thing, and the other thing that came up was the fact that sustainability at the committee was started just about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago at this point, and now we're, as one committee member of the committee described it, basically eliminating it from our purview, and I somewhat disagree with that. I think this committee is use of sustainability, or focus of sustainability, we actually get much more gravitas when we look at it in parallel with stuff like information technology, transportation, and other infrastructure items. The other thing that's been happening, and I was a big proponent of the sustainability committee 2 years ago, about a year ago, I really wanted to see it become stronger, have a much wider purview. But that was before the creation of the President's Sustainable Campus Committee and approximately 10 sustainability working groups that will be basically taking off over the next couple months, focused on everything from water to transportation to buildings to climate, all sorts of different things. And that's really going to be where a lot of the sustainability efforts are going to be
moving, I think, over the next couple of years.
Whose committee is that?
This is, so there's actually a couple of new things going on. There's going to be a sustainability forum, which will comprise several vice presidents, a couple of deans, and the director of the Cornell Center for a Sustainable Future. And this is going to be the high-level group that's going to be setting the sustainability priorities for the university over the next couple of years in terms of what direction to get it to go in. Below that, there's the President's Sustainable Campus Committee, which is chaired by VP Kuang and Professor Tim Fahey from Natural Resources. And this is basically a management system designed to basically integrate sustainable practices across campus, across our very decentralized operation. And under that committee, there's approximately 10 working groups that are seeking to do that with members from all sorts of different units. I see that as a potential, the PSCC, the President's Sustainable Campus Committee, as a potential associated committee. I don't know if they're at the point yet in their formation where they want to have that tie to the University Assembly, but I see that as a future thing that might pop up.
Well, it seems to me that of the four topics here, sustainability, information technology, transportation, and any other topic relative to infrastructure, only the sustainability is really not part of infrastructure.
I mean,
the other three are infrastructure.
Yeah.
Transportation, information technology, that's infrastructure of universities. So maybe what you're saying is, let's scratch item number one there.
But that's the real difficult thing, I think, with the word sustainability in governance. It's a beautiful word. I use it all the time. But it's just too broad. It can encompass a whole bunch of different things. And one of the Higher Education Sustainability Council's groups is actually putting out this 300-page document for how schools, colleges, and universities should assess themselves sustainably. And that includes everything from investment to diversity to student access, all sorts of different things. So they're defining sustainability very broadly.
So, again, what you're saying is, it sounds like, A, that doesn't belong under infrastructure, sustainability doesn't, and B, there are all kinds of groups elsewhere at the university who are watching over this.
Well, so, when the executive committee and the various people that we talked with when we were writing these initially, obviously we have a sustainability committee. Sustainability is something which affects the broad campus community, and we look at it in the context that, with the exception of CIT, because that's a new area, but that doesn't really affect sustainability as we traditionally think of it. But clearly building and transportation interlaces with sustainable action. And so the idea here is that any conversation that talks about transportation should be talking about sustainability. And any conversation that talks about buildings should be talking about sustainability and vice versa. These are intertwined concepts. So I think that sustainability belongs in there. I think it's great to note it, to give emphasis to it. I don't know that we should have a whole other separate committee just for that one thing, because I think then we're compartmentalizing it away.
How about changing the name to Campus Functions Committee?
I like infrastructure more.
I'm sorry. If you guys think it's sustainability belongs, and I hear your argument, then let's just leave it infrastructure. I mean, I'm sorry you don't like infrastructure, but I think the rest of us...
We can talk about other names offline and brainstorm.
Yeah.
Well, it's a better place for sexy things than Pilot.
Yeah. All right, well, how about this? If Mike can come up with a truly amazing name, we'll have a resolution in the next month.
Okay, that sounds
good. Well, I just wanted to address
the Wilbur Mills Committee.
Is there any other charge-related issues?
Sense of community referendums. We could do a poll.
I'm sorry, charge. I had a question on 2.1.
Go for it.
But it says, this is dealing with if something's appealed to the ombudsman. It says, by majority vote, the assembly may suspend any of its actions related to the appeal until the ombudsman makes a final ruling on the appeal. I don't think the ombudsman provides any kind of rulings on anything. People bring things to the ombudsman, and they hash out the discrepancies, and they give opinions on things, but I'm not sure ruling...
I think it depends who the ombudsman is. I think they have the power to make a decision like that.
No, I don't think
they,
so.
No, they absolutely do not. And I'm uniquely informed recently. And correct. And I would I would change that final opinion or an opinion on the appeal. Or, I mean, in other words, the idea, the concept there, I have no objection to, but I don't think they don't put out a document saying, they're not an arbitrator. Uh-huh. And I made very clear that they're not an arbitrator.
They're just a listener.
Correct. And a facilitator, yeah. Where they can be.
So instead of maybe waiting like Tom Button makes a recommendation.
Yeah, we'll consult the ombudsman in case.
Well, hang on. Has anybody ever appealed a assembly action to the ombudsman? Can't even pronounce the ombudsman.
Hang on. Doing assembly actions all the time.
How would it ever happen? I mean, all we do is make recommendations to the president, for heaven's sake.
Right.
Yeah. Anybody can bring any topic to the ombudsman that they choose.
But he makes the
That's correct. He works for nobody. But everybody.
This was in the.
Takes their input very seriously.
I think
This obviously came out in the Legal Beagle Review, I think. I would presume. It wasn't there before.
Ari just said it's in the previous bylaw.
Personally, I'd get rid of it.
Get rid of it.
Doesn't mean
anything. Yeah, right.
Okay.
I mean, I think if somebody sent the ombudsman, and we even learned about it, we'd be interested in the ombudsman's input, and I know the committee would take it seriously, but they don't issue rulings, and if they did, it wouldn't be binding. So
you're absolutely right.
They've got them.
Yeah. Take it up.
Yeah, might be that.
Yeah,
just get rid of
it. Yeah, this piece down here.
It reduces the number of articles.
Yes.
Infringement on a person's rights.
Speaking of sex.
This whole section was taken out.
Maybe we can put a picture in there instead.
Then the appeal to the ombudsman is that we're overstepping our power, I guess.
Well, we don't have power.
We don't have power.
You're right, exactly.
Have you read our new Bible? Our new Constitution?
I have a question. I emailed you about this, and it was like years ago, seemingly. It's probably gotten lost in the email ether.
Wait, I'm sorry, not to interrupt you, but do we have a resolution on the ombudsman? Should we strike it out?
Motion to strike.
Second. Strike it out? Okay. We'll strike out the ombudsman.
All in favor?
I think we have to vote.
All opposed? All abstaining? Good.
I don't think we'll renumber the rest of the bylaw.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I just wanted to resolve that.
Yeah, no good.
My question, moving on, speaking of committees, is Article 4.2.2, which I guess is now 3.2.2.
Don't do that.
So as it reads in the December 1st draft, it says, except where otherwise provided, each standing committee consists of two representatives, at least one of whom must be a voting member of the assembly, of each constituency of the assembly who serve terms concurrent with a session of the assembly. The committees only have two members? Is that right?
This paragraph's ambiguous to me. I thought the intent was that there had to be eight members then, two from each of the constituents, of which one of each of the constituents must be a voting member of the Senate. So four voting members, eight. I was I just thought, golly, we got to live up to that. That's a lot of...
Well,
a lot of...
If it would help, I can read the version that it was before.
Try that.
It isn't from the draft, the one that is marked few broad from November or whatever it is. It's Article 5.2.3 in that version. Except where otherwise provided, the Executive Board may appoint two of its voting members from each constituency to serve terms on a standing committee concurrent with a session of the Assembly. The Executive Board may remove members from standing committees as needed. My guess is that the intent is supposed to be the same in both versions of those language. Basically what you were saying, two from each, whatever, one of whom has to be a voting member, that sort of thing. So I suppose my suggestion is that we take the one from the previous draft and put it into, and just simply replace Article 422, or now 322.
Yeah, and I had the same comment. I wasn't quite sure what the intent was. Two members, eight members?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it
clear.
It was not.
It wasn't clear. I think it's supposed to be eight members, two of each.
The earlier text is pretty clear.
One? Yeah, I think the earlier text is fine, which says exactly that.
Yeah.
Eight members, two from each. Yep.
One
staffed by the executive board.
I would like to raise a question, which is not defined anywhere that I can find. What is a session of the assembly?
Isn't it defined?
I think it's defined at the beginning
at
of
the beginning
charter.
Of the charter.
Oh, is it? Okay, I didn't look
in
the charter.
Yes. Okay. So what are we doing with
the We're going to change the language back.
Yeah, there it is. Session of the assembly.
Yes, here it is.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
So the membership, we're going to change back to the...
Motion to revert the language.
Okay,
take 523 and put it into 422,
yes.
Which is now 322.
This is the language?
I think that's clear.
Yeah.
And I think the intent of the current version is the same.
The only change is that this is... Each standing committee will consist of, this says, may appoint.
Yeah, I mean, my question is, who's on these committees? Reading the current 422, I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
It reads to me like each committee consists of only two people.
Right. Yeah. So this reads to me, basically every committee will only be UA members. It will only be voting UA members.
It says of each constituency, then say members.
Of the assembly's voting members.
Okay.
So my only point here was
not
say,
people.
Well,
I think there are only three graduate students on the new UA.
Exactly. So,
I think the original model for the committees was there were two appointed from each constituency. One of whom was a member of each constituency's assembly, and then on top of that, there were three university assembly members.
Stepping away from the language for a moment.
What do we want?
Yeah.
Why don't we just do that? How do we want the membership to be?
I
think we're circling around the same general.
Where this comes up is in relation to Randy's point, the issue of having a in this case, a subcommittee on childcare, but a subcommittee on whatever, on Xbox. You know, who can be on that subcommittee? Is it restricted to members of the parent committee? And if so, who's on the parent committee?
I know the answer to that, which is...
Well, I know what Robert's rule says.
Okay, well...
It is restricted to members of the standing committee. And
unless the assembly approves the appointment of somebody else who doesn't even have to be a member of the assembly at all.
But then we would need, I think, the way I read Robert's rules, language in our bylaws that specifically authorizes that members of subcommittees, that subcommittees need not consist solely of members of the parent committee. Which is fine. We can overrule Robert's rules.
Well, Zola, let's conceptually talk about that then. It seems like we've got two things here. What do we want the membership of the standing committee to look like, and do we want to give the authority to have subcommittees that include members who are not voting members of the standing committee?
I think I like what Mike described. I think we want to make sure that UA members are a significant part of our standing committees, because this is the whole issue, that we don't know what our standing committees are doing. If we make sure that there's a significant overlap in membership, we will obviously know what they're doing.
We did talk about math, I think, at one point. I spouted out a couple numbers, and those numbers were based on a 2-2-2-2-3 model. 11-12 model, 2 from each constituency, 3 from UA.
Two times four plus three.
Where is that parentheses? 4 plus 3 times 2?
Do we want something like that? Or do we want to do something?
I don't think we need
it. And what that allowed for was, an executive board of the UA, about 12 members to be involved in these three, nine members to be involved in these three committees, and then, you know, a couple other members involved in associate committees.
How does that sound before?
And that basically got us to the number of 19.
So three of us on every committee, and then we tell the constituent assemblies, you give us two members for each committee.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the subcommittees ought to have a majority of their membership from the committee, but they certainly ought to be able to add others.
Right. Yeah.
As needed.
That's
this
what you want
where
the original workhorse is to be, the people with a passion for whatever it is.
Exactly, yeah.
But I think Charlie's right about the majority of members of the subcommittee being present.
So do we want to add language that says subcommittees, the majority membership of the subcommittee should be members of the committee or the
assembly?
Members, subcommittees may include membership that is not part of the committee with approval of the assembly. Does that make
sense? Yeah. I would think it would be sort of pro forma, the chairman of the.
Well, what I would say is something a little bit different than that. Say rather than approval of the assembly, I would say approval of the parent committee. So that the our standing committees create their own subcommittee.
Yeah, I like that.
And,
yeah.
That they be a majority of members of that standing committee.
Yeah, I agree.
Because again, and this is what Robert's Rule says, it's a sort of chain of communication, that there's back and forth overlap, and that it's all going, you know, toward the assembly as a whole.
So, the conditions for the subcommittees are. A majority of their members have to be members of the committee.
Of the parent committee.
Of the committee.
Parent committee. And any non-members of the committee who are appointed must be approved by that committee.
Well, how about something like this? Language in the bylaws off the top of my head. Standing committees may create subcommittees. To consist of whomever they choose, provided a majority of the members are of the standing committee. And that sort of takes out the, you know, approving members of, they're just creating the committee to contain those members, or non-members, or whatever. Right. I'd be happy to actually draft that line.
Well, is it the chair who's making the call there, or does the committee have to have a majority vote?
I think the committee has to vote on that.
Yeah, the committee should vote. Yeah.
Andrew, I'm sorry, Randy.
I'm wondering about the majority of the committee versus, say, a number like three. And the reason I say that, the child care subcommittee has somebody from the Ithaca school system and somebody from... like DSS or something, and just a whole bunch of people from different walks of life that deal with child care. And I can't imagine
I don't mean to interrupt. When you're down.
Okay, I just think that we'd be better off as a minority in a community like that.
If I may respond to that point, I think part of what's behind the thinking in this particular model is a sort of congressional way of doing things. I know that's the language that Tommy Bruce has used. Certainly this is the way it works in Canada, where we shuffle our parliament or our cabinet every time, you know, the moon changes. The person who is the Secretary of Transportation Minister of Transportation, isn't necessarily a transportation expert. They're just the point person on that, and they have sort of assemble a team. Anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that the child care subcommittee or family services or whatever could bring in members who are experts on things, but whether or not they're a member of the committee is, to me, immaterial, because they're not, I mean, that's the idea is that the committee or subcommittee is crafting this language and then vetting it past experts.
Exactly.
You know, holding hearings the way congressional hearings the Congress does.
All right.
I realize we're out of time.
Yeah, so we're out of time. Just the last thing, we're obviously going to have to carry this over to the next meeting to continue talking, but I think Randy had something you want to bring up from Mina, right?
Mina Edmondson made some amendments for the campus planning committee that essentially just emphasizes that the campus planning committee should interact with anybody doing sustainability.
We should look at those next time. Okay.
Yeah, we'll look at those.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just one more.
Motion to extend to 5 minutes to look at the Bill of Rights quickly.
Yeah.
I'll miss my bus. I've got to leave.
Okay. All right.
31 bucks?
Yeah.
We can put it on the agenda for next
Let's
time.
Let's put it on the agenda for next time. We've given it to Andrew so we can
read
it. And we'll talk about it next time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. All in favor?
Aye. The opinion of the chair of the eyes.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.